Hey everyone, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Device Talks weekly podcast. Lots going on today. Chris Neumarker is back with the Newsmakers, so we'll be bringing those to you, and we'll have later on a conversation I did with Harry Rowland. He's the CEO of Endotronics. Great medtech story. They got FDA approval for their Credela sensor for heart failure, and we'll learn about all that went into getting the job done. Before we begin, I'd like to ask for a few considerations. If you would register for Device Talks West, it's happening October 16th and 17th at the Santa Clara Convention Center. Lots of great programs. We'll be talking about interventional neurotech, structural heart, connected health, surgical robotics, and many, many more topics. We'll have keynotes, including Adam Elsesser, the CEO of Penumbra, Heather Knight of Baxter, Andy Pierce of Stryker, and Tori Smith of Endiatics, and I've got another keynote that I'll be announcing soon, and of course, great presentations by leading OEMs. So join us at Device Talks West. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register for that, and the early bird rate is still in effect for the next couple of weeks, so make sure you save yourself a couple of $100. Looking in the near future, we'll have our Device Talks Tuesdays coming up with TE Connectivity. You can register for that. That's free, and you can watch that live or on demand. It's going to be a great conversation about laser cutting and other welding solutions for advanced, minimally invasive medical devices. TE Connectivity always does a great job. So make sure you register for that at devicetalks.com. All right. Without any further delay, let's get this podcast started. All right. You ready for this?
Ready.
Chris Neumarker, how are you, sir?
Tom Salemi, good to be here, man.
It's been so long.
It has been.
Promise people a newsmarker, newsmakers, newmarkers, newsmakers, and I think we did, what, one, maybe
two? My gosh,
two,
you've, and then you've grown a goatee since I last talked to you. Oh, wait, you've always had that. Wait, I'm sorry.
I forgot
about your goatee. It's been so long.
This is not a goatee. This is hardly even a van. This is one of those unshaven beard kind of things.
Oh, yeah.
Just got too gray. I do have the weird, and if anyone Googles my name, you'll see an internet photo with the black and white with my goatee, which finds its way on marketing material from time to time.
It's true. You're kind of doing what I'm doing now. You're kind of doing the, like, you know, the just that little bit of.
Yeah. I'll describe folks at home. Chris and I are holding our chins up and looking at the camera so we can properly describe our pseudo beard. No, I have the trim it every 2 days, kind of down.
Yeah,
it's so good, so damn white. It's like if I let it grow, any, it just, it looks like I got hit with flour in my face. So I'm just trying to keep it close.
Me too, man. I'm getting there too, man. Just gotta shave it close. Gotta get that.
Oh,
do that beard,
you're
close.
Just you're a young fella. You're a young fella. So we've got some news to report. Anything on your end? And how's the Minnesota summer treating you? We didn't get a weather report in a very long time. Any snow?
No snow. We had we're talking on a Thursday, and there was a heck of a windstorm last weekend. Like, so,
a windstorm.
Yes, even got the family to a hotel because we lost power for a day. But
oh my goodness, I didn't know that.
But it was a blast for the kids. They were like, "There's a pool." There's a breakfast buffet the next morning before they head off to preschool and, you know, camp and stuff. I mean, you know, we got all the food from our freezer over to the freezer of the Homewood Suites. So, we probably saved $100 worth of meat just doing that. So, I mean, that paid for itself.
Super smart. You know? Super smart.
Yeah.
Was this one of those kid-sized pools? Like, they say it's a swimming pool and then you get there and it's like 3 feet deep and like 8 feet by 10 feet, like,
or was it was okay. It was okay. It wasn't like
the kids little, don't care. The kids are fine with the little pools.
Kids,
they love,
thought
little
it
pools.
Was awesome. There was a fun moment when they were in the pool and the power went off in the hotel. So,
ooh.
Which, you know, it was like, oh, is this happening here now? But then it came back on like maybe 20 minutes later. It's like, okay, you know, like all right, good. Like, it's good.
Count that as a vacation someday. Remember that time we went to the Homewood Suites? Good times.
Good times. And you're just boiling in New England, right? It's just hot.
We have some heat. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's. I would like a little less heat. But it's not. I have a difficult time complaining about heat. Like, I've got relatives in Houston and, you know, people down there, and it's just like, I'm fine.
We're I'm fortunate. Fine. We live in more northern climate. You know? Yeah. Heat's more this is, you know, it's kind of fun. It's hot.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm a little sticky. Yeah.
It's a day to go to the pool or, you know, like, you know, pour myself an extra iced tea today or something. You know?
Yeah. Or thank goodness I have AC. Yeah. So,
air conditioning.
So we're doing fine.
Blessed air conditioning, yes.
Let us roll into our new markers newsmaker. So we've got five. We're going to go with five.
Gonna do it. Five new markers newsmakers.
And we're going to be doing this every week, right?
Yeah.
We're going to keep this up.
We're going to do it.
We are back.
We're back.
Newsmakers are back. So, folks, you want to hear what's latest? The latest in medical device news. Make sure you're subscribed to the Device Talks Podcast Network, so you get this this puppy sent directly to you on Friday, whenever I'm able to cobble it together and send it out, which is usually around 6 o'clock Eastern. So if you're West Coast, you can drive home listening to this and you will know, you know, you'll be all caught up. You're good. You're ready to go. So
it's good to go.
East Coast, get up on Saturday morning, walk the dog, and you know what happened.
Get some MedTech news.
It's cool.
Well, here we go.
So before we roll in though, Device Talks West is happening October 16th and 17th. At the Santa Clara Convention Center. Registration is open. We've got a lot of great tracks, interventional surgical robotics, structural heart, connected health, neurotech, women's health, and we'll have an innovation track, and I'm forgetting one more. But it's going to be very cool. Lots of great speakers. So go to west.devicetalks.com to register. All right, Chris Neumacher. What is number five?
Let's go. Number five, we've got the news with the proxy fight going on over at Masimo. This is the digital health company with all kinds of wearables and diagnostic products, pulse oximeters. They've been in this we've both covered business for a long time. We've seen a lot of proxy fights, but this one, I don't know. Tom, this one seemed especially contentious. I mean, I don't think the day's gone by where I haven't gotten something in my inbox from Masimo saying our engineers say they're going to resign if Politan knocks out our CEO Joe Chiani, and Politan's saying, oh, you're trying to strong arm your engineers into signing onto these letters and the next thing you know, it's almost like Paulden might as well be saying that Joe Chiani wakes up in the morning and drowns puppies in a bucket, and then they have to deny that, but anyway, it's gotten to the point now that, Masimo has delayed their shareholders meeting, which was supposed to happen this month to September. And they've, sued Paulden, saying that, claiming that Paulden and, Quentin Coffey, who's been on their board from Politan, after a proxy fight last year, has been, making material misstatements and omissions in their proxy materials. So it's, come to this. So now I'll be, following this lawsuit.
No, it's certainly, I'm not getting those emails from anybody talking about anything, but I know it's definitely been.
I won't send it. I won't get you on their list. You can stay.
No, that's totally fine. But I mean, Masimo, I remember we talked about them a lot a couple of years ago when they acquired Sound United, and they were kind of moving into all these interesting spaces. I know they, in May, looked to sell off some of their consumer products, and I think they have an interesting bid going on there for that.
Yeah.
So,
that was kind of one of the big things. Just to back up a bit, they acquired Sound United and their high-end speaker brands a few years ago, and that just made sense with their digital health play that, these were digital products that went in people's homes that were connected. Sound United knew how to connect things in people's homes. Well, they wanted to get health monitoring into people's homes, Politan, kind of rode in, I think, kind of on the on the skepticism over what Chiani and Masimo were doing there. And we've reached the point now where, Masimo management has been, saying they're working with a third party for some kind of deal, some kind of partnership, joint venture that would, split off you know, the consumer business. I kind of recall from the materials going back and forth in the proxy fight, you know, kind of like, you know, part of the idea has been that Keanu would actually go and run that consumer business. You know, Politan has been saying they're not doing enough with us, you know, and they're, you know, so it's.
And Massimo's not disclosing the joint venture partner you wrote last week, July 9th.
Yeah, not disclosed.
Someone's offering $850 to $950 million purchase price.
Yep.
For Viper Holdings, which is the parent company of Sound United, and Massimo paid $1.025 billion for that in 2022.
And Massimo is saying we're going back.
Give a haircut.
Yeah. They are going back and saying they're going to try to negotiate that more, but yeah.
We were excited about the speaker thing. We were trying to figure out how it fit. I remember we were having conversations about it. I think Brian Johnson might have been on a podcast too. We were kind of all piecing it together. But it was a time when medtech and digital health were really sort of beginning to move into the consumer space. And it's kind of disappointing that we may be, I don't know who's buying this. It'd be interesting who the joint venture partner is.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it's not a medtech. But who knows? It could be. But it's too bad that they're stepping back a bit from what they were trying to do.
They said there could be other partners joining in. Yeah, this is very interesting. So we'll keep on following this because this is quite the story. Meanwhile, I mean, the analysts, the reports that I've been seeing coming over is that they're generally, you know, pretty positive about where things are going at Massimo at this point. So they just happen to have this pretty dramatic proxy fight going on right now.
All right. So the big news is that Massimo is...
They're delaying the shareholders' vote as they
delaying the shareholders' vote, and they're suing Politan. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Let us move on to number four, Chris Newmark.
Well, number four, just really quick. I mean, we've been talking about, you know, Stryker is, you know, really focused on M&A right now, and they just had a nice little tuck-in acquisition announced this week, the soft tissue fixation developer Artelon. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right.
I think you are. I'll go with that.
Artelon.
Artelon.
Yeah,
so you would have Peloton. So I think Artelon. I think I'm good with Artelon.
Soft tissue fixation products for foot and ankle and sports medicine procedures.
So this fills out Stryker's, obviously, their orthopedic business. I know I saw Spencer Stiles talking about the acquisition earlier this week on LinkedIn. And it's not the kind of acquisition, though, you would promise, though, Chris Newmark, when you wrote Chris, that Kevin Lobo was looking at M&A. I think we're all expecting something bigger. I think you got to deliver something bigger, Chris Newmarker. This is not going to do it.
Yeah. What do you mean? It's a nice tuck-in.
We don't want tucks.
You're expecting a New York strip, and I just gave you like a little piece of sirloin with. I mean, there's some bacon on it, Tom.
No, it's a great deal. It's a great deal.
I wrap bacon around it. I mean, it's good. Right?
I think we're all waiting for we released our Stryker Talks episode this week. I interviewed Andy Pierce. Of course, he's head of neurosurgery and MedSurg. Within that is their tower business and their surgical suite business. And I did talk to him about, as I asked Spencer Stiles when I talked to him a couple of months ago, about acquiring our surgical robotics company. And Andy similarly did not say no. You know, he said, look, we're going to see what's out there. You know, we're happy that everyone else is making progress in this space because ultimately we want the patients to get better care. We're aware of what everyone else is doing, and we've got great people who are out there looking at our next opportunity. So we're hoping for that big piece of steak.
And I mean, Stryker is already, you know, becoming larger. I mean, actually the big thing I've been doing this week has been crunching our you know, numbers for our big MedTech Big 100 report that you know, comes out, you know, like at the end of August, early September on medical design outsourcing. And it's analysis of the 100 largest MedTech companies in the world, like based on their annual reports. And I mean, just a little teaser, Stryker's moving up on the list. I mean,
interesting. And it's up high.
It was already up high, but they're ticking up. Maybe I would say, like, you could now, if you counted the first five companies on your hand, they'd be there.
So you could find Stryker on one little hand is what you're saying.
Yes.
It's on there somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because when you posted and you made a bit of a change to your largest orthopedics companies a month or two ago. Mm-hmm. You recalculated that. You subtracted, I think rightly, subtracted neurotech and MedSurg from their orthopedics business, mm-hmm. and then compared the apples to apples. So when you did that, I think J&J was, DePuy was just slightly bigger, correct?
Exactly,
J&J was number one, and Stryker was just a hair smaller. And maybe this Artelon will push them over to the number one slot in orthopedics as well.
That little tick up there. I mean, it's going to be interesting to watch J&J MedTech, you know, grow as well. Because when this list comes out in a month, look at the gap now revenue wise between Medtronic and Johnson & Johnson MedTech. Medtronic's feeling a little some footsteps behind them, you know, as the largest med tech company. We'll see. You got to read that report in a month.
I'm guessing these numbers would not include any Shockwave revenue, or do they include Shockwave revenue?
They do not yet.
So next year will be interesting to see what happens.
It's going to be very interesting. Yes.
J&J MedTech, I think this week was talking about the impact that Shockwave could have on their bottom line. So
yeah.
That's going to be a high growth engine for them.
Yeah, really.
All right, Chris Newmarker. Cool stuff. Number three, speaking of Medtronic.
Well, number three on the list. Yep, there we go. We got Medtronic. And, they announced that they've launched their new live stream function for the touch surgery ecosystem of digital technologies. And this is about does that sound familiar at all, Tom?
Anybody who was at Device Talks Boston would have had a little sample of this.
They would have seen an expert surgeon on vegetables.
Exactly. I helped perform a life-saving pepperoctomy, advising the surgeon in England which seed needed to be removed from the red pepper. And it was a very cool presentation. It closed out Device Talks Boston and our robotics summit and expo.
Yeah.
And presentation by Rajit Kamal. He's the head of he's the general manager of the surgical robotics business at Medtronic, and he did a great job. Actually, he did a very good job with the presentation. So
it was a very cool idea that here we were in Boston, and there was a screen projected up, showing what a Hugo, procedure on this pepper was like in England, across the ocean, and we could in fairly real time see what was going on, interact with the people over there. So I mean, this is now launched, and it seems like everything this day seems to have something related to artificial intelligence packaged in with it. I think we're using those words every day on Mass Device at this point. But this live stream includes 14 new AI algorithms to provide insights after the operation, to help improve outcomes and future procedures. So I mean, that's very cool.
Well, I know Medtronic expanded its clinical trial early this year, and they're working toward their submission to the FDA. I'm trying to remember the timing on that. I think they might try to submit by the end of the year, but don't quote me on that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's been stated out there, but certainly folks are watching closely.
Yeah.
To see what Medtronic is up to. As we ran on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and the information that I want is probably on that podcast, I had a conversation with Joe Mullings of the Mullings Group and Steve Bell, a surgical robotics expert, about SRS and about the surgical robotics industry overall. So if you didn't check that out and you're interested, go check it out. And we actually just recorded another sort of review of the first half of the year of surgical robotics with the two of them. Did that on Joe Mullings's platform. So I think that should be going out at some point. So folks can keep an eye out for that. Two good sources for surgical robotics news, in addition to, of course, Mass Device. But
that's right.
Good for Medtronic. They're building out the platform.
Exactly.
And I think we all want more robots out there because number one, they're cool. But number two, I think competition is good for anyone and everyone. So we'll see what happens.
And frankly, it's more than just robots. I mean, something like this. This is about kind of this whole like digital surgery ecosystem, like, you know, with the imaging, the insights, you know.
And the telesurgery capabilities, yeah. Well, this isn't telesurgery. This is kind of more teleconsultation. But at SRS, the Surgical Robotics Society of Robotic Surgery annual meeting last month in Orlando, where I posted some videos from, I was really shocked at how far along a lot of surgical robotic systems are with telesurgery. A lot of the companies in Japan and China are doing long distance surgery, and I think SSI Innovations from India, I think it's done that as well. So it's coming. Wow. I mean, in the U.S., I don't know what the demand will be for having a surgeon in, say, New York and a patient in Europe, but I think as surgical robotics moves into stroke, certainly you could see an opportunity where a surgeon in Buffalo could help a patient in Syracuse or some other part of upstate New York, you know, help them remove a clot where time is brain. So I think
a top surgeon at Mayo Clinic, you know, helping out somebody in rural South Dakota. You know, I mean, that's
exactly
that'd be awesome. That you don't have to live near some, you know, major healthcare hub, you know, to get, you know, access to, you know, surgical expertise.
Yeah. So Medtronic News is another plank on that platform. Yeah. So good news for them. All right, totally. Chris Newmarket, let's move to number two.
Well, number two, we've got ICU Medical closing their facility in Oakdale, Minnesota, and cutting 83 jobs. And just, you know, just this is just news for the Minnesota market because this facility was, you know, was acquired by ICU just, you know, a few years back from their acquisition of Smiths Medical, which was, you know, kind of, you know, this, it was a major, you know, a big presence in the med tech hub here in you know, here in Minnesota, and even like you know, not too far from where I live, I can be you know, if I was driving up, you know, Highway 169 North, I'd see like Smiths Medical's you know, old U.S. headquarters, which, you know, that's a different location around here. But I mean, we're definitely, you know, have been seeing ICU kind of like scaling back kind of the presences, you know, in Minnesota after that acquisition, you know. So we'll be, you know, keeping an eye on where that goes. You know, there was already a facility in Oakdale closed last year, and now this was like the second facility that was closed down.
All right. Well, it's too bad for those folks. I mean, obviously there's a lot of, as you pointed out, Chris, there are a lot of medical device companies in your neighborhood. So hopefully folks will be able to find another gig.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. Well, let's roll on to number one on the New Markers and Newsmakers. I have to get my tongue
new
trained
markers,
to say
newsmakers. Yes.
I want to throw an S into Newsmarker. Newsmakers.
Newsmakers. Like, it's like a new marker.
New markers. Yeah. Exactly. As in a new marker. Yes.
I've never used right, that phrase before. Okay. Number one on the list, we've got Edwards Life Sciences is acquiring a mitral valve company, InnoValve. They're going to pay $300 million in cash on closing. And this just comes a week after they entered into some deals with Afflin Medical, you know, to pay more than $16 million, you know, to license and develop a mitral valve tech. So there, Edwards is, you know, definitely making us some like a TMVR play, which, I mean, for years, TAVR's huge, you know, transcatheter aortic valve replacement. And, you know, for years, you know, that's been kind of like, you know, TMVR has been this next big thing everybody's working towards. So, you know, Edwards, you know, definitely is bolstering itself there.
Absolutely. And this came on the heels. You mentioned the Affluent deal, and that actually posted on that on LinkedIn, and that got a lot of attention for a post about a $16 million deal, but it was just really interestingly structured. The $16 million figure was also, I think, coincidentally, the amount of money that the company lost last year. But it seemed like a real kind of conservative bid by Edwards, which is focusing on structural heart and spun out its critical care business and has billions now possibly to invest in companies. So one of the comments is like, when is Edward is going to start spending some of that critical care money? And then a few days later, they announced the Innoval deal. So Edwards is probably going to be, well, I'm sure we'll hear the name Edwards Life Sciences and the term acquisition in some articles in the future. At least you could certainly see that happen.
Yeah. I would, if I was looking at the crystal ball, if I had a crystal ball available, I could see some more Edwards deals coming in the future on Mass Device.
Absolutely. All right. Well, great stuff on Mass Device this week. Chris Newmarker, it's great to have the newsmakers back on the podcast. And thanks for returning. I missed you so much.
See you next week, man. It'll be awesome. Missed you too.
This is Tom Salami of Device Talks. We're excited to bring you another great program for Device Talks West here at the Santa Clara Convention Center, talking new business models, new missions, and new intentions. I can't wait until we fill this auditorium with MedTech's best engineers, entrepreneurs, and executives. This is Device Talks West.
The foundation of connected care is the who we are that drives the what we do. We shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us.
Thoughtful discussions of how it impacts not only markets, but society and the workforce.
What is it doing for the patient? And that's what our technology needs to be.
I look at what the standard of care is today. Are there areas where we can improve upon the standard of care, or are there areas where there are significant gaps? And that's what drives me.
What am I trying to accomplish? You know, getting back to that core, what problem am I trying to solve? Am I going to do something new and really move the needle for patient outcomes? So there's a ton of work to be done, and that's what keeps me excited.
Why did you choose MedTech? Find out at Device Talks West on October 16th and 17th. Register at west.devicetalks.com.
The folks that are saving lives, they're all here.
Well, Harry Rowland, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Delighted you took a few minutes this week. I thought you'd be on a cruise somewhere celebrating your recent FDA news. As we record this, you just received approval. Can you update our listeners on what the approval is for? I want to make sure that it's reported correctly on the podcast.
Well, no better way to celebrate than with Device Talks in the MedTech ecosystem.
Finally, yes. Someone sees it my way.
The cruise is later, right? It's too close. So we just got PMA approval of our Cordella pulmonary artery sensor system, and we're thrilled to have that milestone in place.
Excellent. Well, we'll unpack what that means and how the system came to be and what it offers for patients. But first, a little bit about your background. How did you find your way into MedTech? Is this kind of your first MedTech gig or? How did it all come
about?
Yeah,
it is. It's been a long, long time in it now, but I was, you know, always drawn to med tech. I think most people in life sciences or engineering who have a bent to healthcare can see the benefit of doing hard work that's worth doing, and you kind of feel that connection to your work. So I always had a leaning that way. I was getting a PhD in mechanical engineering from Georgia Tech, working at technology for a healthcare startup, and just out interviewing physicians and shadowing surgical procedures. And I met a cardiothoracic surgeon in Illinois who was fascinated with wireless pressure sensing. Hmm. So it was coincidental that my PhD was from Georgia Tech, which is where CardioMEMS was from.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I had a baseline familiarity with that, but just that's how I got in. So got in and got in over my head and just kept swimming. And here we are now.
Did you have a sense of where else? I mean, I suppose sensor technology can be used in any industry. It's pretty widespread. You had other options.
Right. Yeah. There were in the technology I was working on PhD, I did not have a healthcare application. It was very fundamental, theoretical and applied science. But healthcare had that draw. My grandfather was a physician. My uncle was a surgeon. My mom was a doctor, didn't practice. So just always had a little bit of leaning and interest there and thought that would be a good market and a good place to go after, solve problems.
So unpack for us a moment the sort of the founding story. You met this doctor who was fascinated by sensor technology, saw a clinical application. A lot of those conversations sort of end there, and you say, "Well, it was an interesting gentleman," and you go on with your life. What? How did you turn that discussion into a company?
So it's certainly more than one discussion, but he was a dreamer, Anthony Nunez, big heart, a very innovative guy. He had been introduced to what CardioMEMS was doing in the AAA space, and just fell in love with the idea and concept. Also, his father was suffering from heart failure, and he's originally from Trinidad, so being disconnected from family members and wanting to be able to stay connected and treat remotely was a theme of his. And as I got involved, I fell in love with the platform technology initially, where I was in my career, and then found out shortly thereafter that my grandfather had heart failure. So we both had this family tie to the disease, fell in love with the technology initially, and then just kept working at it from there.
So what did the early days look like? How did you go about developing this product, step one? What do you...
The early days, I don't like going back that far. It was 17 years ago. So it was chaos, highs and lows, emotional roller coaster. And then really when I met Mike Nagy, who really thrives in the napkin sketch to let's make this real and turn this into a product, who really helped us get traction on the development cycle. So early on, there were ideas. We were working with NASA. We were working with Bradley University. We were in Peoria, Illinois. And then Mike got involved and it really helped us turbocharge the development and moving towards our first preclinical work, which we did at the Cleveland Clinic at the Lerner Research Institute.
We don't have to spend too much time on the early days, but I find this journey fascinating because was there a point where you knew there was that you had something that could be turned into something, or is it years of, gosh, I hope this really works. You know, I'm spending a lot of time on this technology. I'd hate to waste the quote unquote, waste the first 4 or 5 years of my career on something that didn't go anywhere.
Yeah, certainly both of those, right?
Yeah, right.
You need those moments of validation where like we really have something here. And then there are moments of struggle and hardship where you're like, I don't know if this is going to get through this next gate. But you just keep chipping away at it. But the strength of it, the strength of the idea was there. The strength of the technology was there. I'd say our first preclinical work, when we saw our histopathology on that, we had good acute experience. And then the initial healing looked quite good. And we're like, you know, this is going to have legs here. We need to get ready to take it to the next level. So that was a key early moment, as was when CardioMEMS announced their trial results, and we said, this has legs here.
So I don't want to spend too much time on the 17-year number, but I'm always fascinated by medtech professionals like yourself who spend so much time on a single product. What is it like having this moment where it's the ultimate validation? I mean, obviously, you have a lot of work ahead of you, but what does this feel like, just looking back over all that time? Because I think it would be a very rare experience for someone to spend that much time without this degree of certainty of success.
It feels amazing. there's no way about it. It feels fantastic. It's the closer we got to the milestone, I have to say, the bigger the milestone, bigger than I realized what that milestone was and how much it meant. I mean, you always know if you don't get through that gate, game over.
Yeah.
It's all over. But then when you got closer to it, it's like there's not many PMAs every year. There's not many PMAs in cardiovascular med tech.
No.
So these things just are hard to do. And then the closer we got, it was also, well, are we going to get it or not?
Yeah, right.
So you start to have that fear factor build in. But no, it feels tremendous.
Just listening to other people, like I was listening to a podcast about Novo Nordisk, but they were just giving background on clinical trials and this is in pharma, but just in the length of time it takes and the length of expense. And they were speaking with such wonder and amazement, like, oh my God, phase one, this percentage goes to phase two. And for us, I think it's just the world we live in and talk about. We know there's a lot more failure than success. So to be part of one of those success stories, I just think must feel, as you said, feels great.
That is great. Yeah, these things take time. They're hard work.
Yeah.
Med tech is humbling, right? Nothing, you can't take anything for granted. You let your guard down, you're going to get punched in the face right away.
Yep. So
you just have to earn every inch and learn from it and constantly develop. But with time, if you can make it through time, you can really have a tremendous impact on patients. And that's one thing that come back. You're always focused on solving problems to get to that PMA. And every day is, okay, what problem am I going to work on solving today? You just constantly focus on problems. So when those patient stories come back, mm-hmm. and you can pause and think, wow, we're really impacting patients' lives. That's the fuel that drives you and gets you through those tough patches that you were asking about earlier.
When did you become CEO, and was that kind of part of your plan, or were you the person who stood still when everyone else took one step back and you were kind of named CEO? How did that come to be?
All of the above. I mean, you've got a way of covering all bases with how you framed the question. No, so I started as CTO. I had technical background. I did a master's in economics as I was getting my bachelor's in engineering. So I was always interested in that intersection of business and tech. But my co-founder, Anthony, a heart surgeon, he was the original CEO. When we had that moment of, hey, we have something here that I shared earlier, was we need to take this to the next level and bring in experience to help us. So we brought in Reed Pryor as CEO in 2010, mm-hmm. and he was a medtech veteran. He had done probably 10, 12 CEO companies, raised hundreds of millions of venture dollars, done exits. So he came in to really get us ready for the next level. That time period also happened to coincide with very tough time in MedTech venture coming out of the financial crisis. But we really advanced a lot under Reed's leadership. He took me under his wing. I learned a ton from him about the industry, met a lot of people in venture, met a lot of people at Strategics. And then when CardioMEMS actually did not get their FDA approval on the first pass, that's when we had to reset, and that's when it was, hey, I'll step forward and be the CEO for this next phase and see us through this winter period and onto the other side. And so from there, it was just a lot of on-the-job growth.
Well, let's talk about that, but in the terms of development of the product. What happened at that period, and how does a company respond to news that isn't really your own, but it just, in this sector, you're right, one piece of bad news can just wash over everybody in this space. What was that period of like, and talk about how you sort of took product development from that point forward?
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, in MedTech, you're absolutely impacted by events around you.
Yep.
It's not just what you control. So when that news happened, we felt great about the data. What was shown in the data, when you can kind of step back from the noise, it was compelling. And we felt there's something here.
Yeah.
If we can survive, we knew we were not going to be able to do venture round for quite some time. So we knew the financing environment was going to be closed to us for a year plus. So it was about getting lean, surviving, moving the development forward that we could, moving the patents forward that we had, really doubling down on where we were with our development to get ready for just catheter delivery, getting it ready to be a product, but knowing we had to do that at a slower pace.
Mm-hmm.
So coming out of that is when we had to make the call that, hey, if we don't move now, we're going to die on the vine. So we kind of started making that transition in the 2013 time period. And ultimately, CardioMEMS got PMA approval in 2014. And that's when the fundraising market started to open up a bit.
Do you change your technology, your design? Is Cordella, today's Cordella, I mean, obviously it has gone through iterations, but did that period change what you were trying to do? Or is it just a matter of kind of slowing the pace and taking all the steps you needed to take just more deliberately and less costly, less expensively?
I'd say early on we started as platform technology, not necessarily exclusively focused on heart failure.
Okay.
We really started to focus on heart failure in 2010, 2011 timeframe. Development was slow then. And there's only so much you can do during those phases. You need a critical mass of talented minds and dollars to put to work to really progress on the development. So I'd say the technology evolved during that time. Certainly there was a tremendous amount of innovation to bring the product to life from that time period. So it evolved quite a bit, but within that same thesis of a mobile, easy to use reader with an implantable sensor.
Well, let's talk about what we're talking about. Let's talk about Credela. Tell our listeners about it, what it does and how it does it.
Sure. Yeah. And still tying this back to the start of the story, we started in June 2007. And if you can think back that far, that's when the iPhone was introduced to the world.
That's right.
But this theme of data should be easy, accessible anytime, anywhere, mobility, that was a theme that was prominent as we were getting into healthcare and getting into sensor technology. So it's kind of the fusion of these themes led to the core invention behind the company, which was a way to make a wireless pressure measurement. So to power a sensor without a battery and to sense the information back from it with a mobile handheld device. So that was the core innovation of the company that was developed then and is the core differentiation still today.
That's a fascinating point that I've never actually heard made before. And I covered MedTech at the time and I wrote about technology and companies and startups. And I never wrote a story saying the iPhone that just came out is going to be an amazing platform for medical devices in 15 or 20 years. I wish I had. Did that news, did it land with people like you? Did you see that like, wait a minute, this, someday this might be sort of a way that we're engaging patients?
I can't say that directly.
Yeah.
I can't say I have that clairvoyance. But even before then you had Blackberries and things like that. But just the ease of use and the consumerization and the consolidation of tech into one device, you didn't necessarily notice it immediately then as transforming the world and Apple becoming the biggest company in the world. But those themes were really driving a lot of economic factors around us. And you just respond to that.
Really, really interesting. So a little more about Credela. What is it?
Coming back to Credela. So we started with this platform technology of you have a small batteryless sensor and focus primarily on pressure that you can put anywhere in the body. And now we have a reader that's easy to use to measure that pressure in that patient anytime, anywhere. And now how do we apply this for heart failure? And that's where the evolution of the journey over time, the connection, a more direct connection to family members who are suffering with heart failure. Mm-hmm. That's where over time in those lean years, we started to embrace our position as a heart failure management company. So it was not about the device. It was not about med tech. It's how do we use this to create an experience for a patient that's really going to help that clinical episode. So that's where we started to marry digital health themes with our device. So we have this strength of mobility, ease of use. Mm-hmm. And then we build around that an ease of use in digital health. So the patient interacts with a tablet. We also layer in Bluetooth connected blood pressure and weight, because those are cornerstones of heart failure management, with our easy to use PA pressure measurement. And then we make that information accessible to the patient. They can see their data. And then we connect the cardiology practice to that entire data set, which is exactly what a cardiologist would get from a patient in an office visit. Mm-hmm. It's the information they need to make a care decision. So we really built an ecosystem for optimizing medication of heart failure patients beyond thinking about this as just remote monitoring.
Talk about how Credela is delivered, where it's delivered, and how it remains where it's supposed to remain to do all this really cool stuff.
Sure. So it's classic med tech in the sense that we have a catheter-based procedure that's going to deliver a permanent implant. So you have your catheter technology, you have your nitinol for the implant, and then you have implantable electronics. So it's a venous access, either jugular vein or femoral vein. It's a right heart catheterization, much like a Swan-Ganz catheter would be placed to measure pressures inside the heart. So through the vena cava, right atrium, right ventricle, through the pulmonic valve, and we leave the device in the right intermediate pulmonary artery. We insert our delivery system over the guide wire, pull a knob on the handle of the catheter, release the device, and then the implant deploys permanently inside the patient's pulmonary artery. And then you take the catheter out, short calibration procedure, and then the patient can go home the same day. So it's less than an hour procedure outpatient.
So what kind of patient is now that it's FDA approved, what kind of patient will be instructed or advised to get Cordella implanted?
So this is for a class 3 heart failure patient. So heart failure is measured in New York Heart Association functional class. A class 2 patient could be sitting here having this conversation, go walk to their car in the parking lot, and they're okay. A class 3 patient, if they have to go walk to their car in the parking lot, they're going to be short of breath from that episode. So their exercise tolerance is limited. Their quality of life is limited. That's our patient. That's our target patient. They've probably had heart failure for several years already. They were diagnosed probably 3-5 years ago with a heart failure hospitalization. They've seen a cardiologist. They've been on medications, and they're still struggling to stay out of the hospital. So that's our target patient. It can be a patient with reduced ejection fraction or preserved ejection fraction. This works for all types of heart failure patients across that spectrum. Our label doesn't require a recent hospitalization, so there's no time period on when the patient had that recent hospitalization, simply that they have class 3 symptoms and they're on appropriate medications for heart failure. And from there, we can help them.
So what is this patient is walks to their car, needs to stop a few times to catch their breath and to regain themselves. They go to the doctors. The doctor instructs them to get this to Cordella implanted. What happens next for that patient? What is the treatment that helps them maybe elevate themselves if they can to a class 2? What kind of treatments follow the sensing?
Yes. So the goal is absolutely to get them to a better functional class. Yep. So increase their exercise capacity, improve their quality of life, keep them out of the hospital. So when they go home that same day, they take home with them our reader and a kit in a travel bag. So we have a tablet that the patient takes home along with Bluetooth connected blood pressure, pulse ox, and weight. And our reader is Bluetooth connected to that tablet. And so they're now going to commit to every morning, they're going to wake up and they're going to take this 3-5 minute routine of answering a few health symptom questions and measuring their vitals and PA pressure. They'll just do that every morning and go about their day. That information enables the cardiology team, the heart failure cardiologist, heart failure nurses, to start optimizing that patient's medications. So now that you can see them at home, that's where you spend the most of your life. That's where the symptoms really matter, not in the office or in the hospital. Now the clinicians can see what their vital signs and PA pressure are, and they can optimize meds, typically increasing doses of certain guideline-directed medical therapies in a way that the patient can tolerate it. Doing that can get their pulmonary artery pressures lower. And it's been shown very clearly in literature, if you can lower a patient's pulmonary artery pressure, you can dramatically reduce their mortality risk and extend the patient's life and improve their quality of life. So you're reducing and managing their congestion. And that's what gives the patient a more full life when they're at home, and it keeps them out of the hospital.
What information were doctors previously, up until this approval, or are currently today, I suppose, making those adjustments upon? Is it just the patient coming in and do they have a diary? What kind of data can the patient share with the doctor to help the doctor adjust their treatments to help to improve their mortality and help them feel better?
So the office visit for a heart failure patient, there are always, clinicians are trying to assess congestion.
Yep.
with very insensitive means. So they'll look for jugular vein distent or distension, maybe swelling of the ankles, edema. They're trying to get a sense of what is congestion, and they take their vitals. They take blood pressure, weight. Is their water weight high? And they're just doing a comprehensive assessment of this patient and then trying to figure out how to change medications almost blindly. That clinical assessment is very difficult to have a quantitative, true measure of the patient's status. Guidelines for heart failure today are send that patient home and have them write in their log, what is their weight, what is their blood pressure? And nobody can see that information. If you have that patient brings that to an office visit, 3 months of logs in a notebook of weight and blood pressure, nobody can do anything with that information.
Right.
So clinicians know what to do when they have the information that can empower them to act. So when they can see PA pressure and they see these strong trends and knowing what the blood pressure is, they're not worried about white coat hypertension, things like that. They can really aggressively address what the patient needs. And so really, is it vasodilation? Is it diuresing? Our system gives that clinician the window to make confident treatment decisions that are effective.
I think I'm not sure how other sensing devices work, but I think a lot of them previously anyway would send data directly to doctors' offices. How important is it to have the patient as part of this process and to see data themselves?
We think it's foundational, yeah. Really. I mean, if you think about yourself and your loved ones, really trying to manage a disease. So this is a chronic disease. You're going to live with this the rest of your life. So you need to be engaged with it. You can't, as a patient, you can't farm that out completely to somebody else, because it's your habits, your actions, your behaviors throughout a day can have a significant impact on your disease status. What you eat, how you sleep, all of that matters, as well as these important heart failure medications. So there's a lot of talk in heart failure around the compliance problem or adherent patients. You have to embrace that. Mm-hmm. If you can get the patient to buy into a healthy habit, and really knowledge is power to the patient to engage anybody, really to engage, that you can change a behavior which itself can have a profound impact to benefit that patient on top of a new medication at a higher dose.
Do you have a part of Endotronix that is providing support to the patients, that's monitoring their monitoring, that's, you know, reminding them to do things, or is that fall under the doctor's responsibility?
All of the above, really. So it's important. We are not directly involved in care, and really the ultimate sign of success for us would be we're just there in the background.
Right.
This is all about strengthening that patient-clinician connection, because that patient trusts the clinician. The clinician is there to help the patient. We're there to make that easy for them to talk about what matters when it matters. But this is a new medical device therapy. It's not just about providing excellent case support in the cath lab and job done, everybody can go home. It's, hey, when that patient goes home, we're just getting started with the therapy. Mm-hmm. So we do have a team that can call and connect with the patient. We can actually train the patient when they're at home. That's when they're going to be using the device at home. That's when it matters. So we have a support team for anything that the patient needs that's technical. They can call in, but anything related to patient care, that's really connecting the patient and clinician to make those decisions together.
And what is the economic/reimbursement model looks like? Do you have a code of your own? Or are you falling within the office visit? And is this monitoring requiring fewer office visits, or is this just in support of the same number of office visits for doctors?
Sure. So there's two elements to reimbursement. And the first element is around the procedure. So MedTech procedure and the device is paid for out of the reimbursement for the procedure. And we have to tip our cap to the CardioMEMS team for pioneering the clinical evidence and the reimbursement framework. So a reimbursement code exists today for implanting a pulmonary artery sensor for heart failure management. And actually, CMS just opened up a national coverage analysis for this category. So we do expect a national coverage decision for this product category by the end of January. And that can be just fantastic for patient access. This space has struggled with challenging and prior authorization Medicare Advantage policies that are at odds with Medicare for quite some time. And a national coverage decision can tremendously improve patient access for patients in need. So we fit within that coding framework for the procedure. And then once the patient goes home, I want to be deliberate in saying that we focus on management of that patient. So there are codes for physicians to deliver complex chronic care management that are all about thinking about that patient holistically, mm-hmm. whatever care that patient needs. These patients are patients with class 3 heart failure. Nearly every one of them also has hypertension. They have COPD. They have secondary pulmonary hypertension. So it's managing those patients is paid for through the complex chronic care management program, which is new and up and coming and expanding in the U.S.
And final couple of questions, just going back a bit. So we covered when the initial disappointing news of CardioMEMS came out and the impact that had on you. How did you turn that around? I mean, you went on to be able to raise good fundraising numbers, and maybe you can share some deep details there. But how does a company, because I'm sure there's others listening who are trying to overcome or clear a similar hurdle, how do you sort of change the narrative and find your own success? Or more specifically, how did you do that?
So a lot of resilience and a lot of great supporters. And we pieced together angel financing for years. And have to credit Jim Hummer, who's a healthcare entrepreneur in the healthcare services space. He was the anchor private angel investor behind this. He's a visionary for proactive health management, using data to drive healthcare decisions. And he backed us in some very lean moments to get through tough times. But there are always other people interested in the story building. There's always interest from strategics and venture, but it was just tough times in that early 2010 to 2014-15 time period. And then we started to get momentum. We got momentum with some early preclinical work. The market was improving with CardioMEMS getting FDA approval. Strategic interest in that space, that data connectivity intersection of medtech and data. Those themes were driving it. And ultimately, we were able to secure our first anchor venture investment in July 2016, which was the critical mass the company needed to get on this PMA program.
Final question. What is the what does the future look like? Do you expand up indications for this sensor? Do you have other sensors in the pipeline? How does Endotronix's story grow?
Well, the future is bright. We have PMA approval. And, you know, rather than talk about label expansion and the next-gen sensor, you know, it's taken a long time to get this PMA approval, and we have an amazing opportunity to help patients in need right here in front of us. So we're going to be in a big ramp-up to commercialize and get this therapy out there to class 3 heart failure patients who need it. We think there's a tremendous opportunity to help automate some of the treatment guidelines. There's a shortage of heart failure clinicians, both cardiologists and nurses. Mm-hmm. How do you help those patients out in the community? We think our data can enable that. So there's just a tremendous amount of execution, continued innovation, continuous improvement ahead of us. And then, yes, eventually we will get into label expansion. We are running essentially a phase 4 trial with proactive HF2 to open up that category and provide definitive evidence for guidelines there as well.
Yeah, I didn't mean to put more on your plate than you can handle right now.
We'll take it. We like having more work.
Exactly. What have you done for us lately, Endotronix? But I should have asked about this earlier. So CardioMEMS has got their approval. You still needed a PMA. I guess I was kind of seeing them in similar classes. But if you required a PMA, you must be a different technology.
Yeah, it's a permanent implant in the central circulation.
Yeah.
And it's not yet the eighth generation stent, for example. So it's still PMA pathway for this category.
Okay, great. Well, it's a great story. Congratulations. It must feel great
It does. Thank you.
You're giving hope to folks who are listening and who are probably wondering if their day will come. So this is a great MedTech story, Harry. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. Please do remember to join us on Device Talks Tuesdays for TE Connectivity's presentation coming up. Make sure you register for Device Talks West. Go to west.devicetalks.com to register for that. Please, of course, subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss any of our great, 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 great podcasts. And finally, share this episode on social media. And when you do, make sure you tag me, tag Kayleen Brown, tag Chris Newmarker, tag Device Talks, and Mass Device while you're at it, because we'd love to have a broader MedTech conversation with you. And, of course, connect with Chris, Kayleen, and myself on LinkedIn. We'd love to have you as part of our networks. All right, folks, thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Device Talks Weekly Podcast. We'll be right back.